You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
Brisha Wade is the author of the 2021 publication Grieving While Black, an anti-racist take on oppression and sorrow, which was rated one of the best 9 books on grief and is currently required reading in multiple university graduate courses. Although she works as a content strategist at Meta by day, her passion involves using her training as a lay ordained Zen Buddhist chaplain to craft effective DE&I strategies by offering professional development programs to individuals and customized solutions for institutions.
You can sit with us podcast with Lexi B.
Brisha, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So what's in your coffee cup? What we drinking today?
I don't drink coffee. I got nothing but water over here and it's half empty.
So some beautiful H2O.
H2O.
And where are your people from? I think that's an important question because I think that knowing where your people from really gives us a clear understanding of where you come from and where your message comes from.
I would say that my people are from the ocean, from the Atlantic Ocean. The interesting thing about being an African American is that we don't have an official homeland. We were taken from it and then brought somewhere where it doesn't treat us like home. So I feel that our identities and who we are, who we came to be, was really born in that distance between our homeland and where we were brought.
So in a magical realm, you are a descendant of mermaids?
I'll take it. Yes.
Living Atlantis, I'm here for it. As a fellow Black American whose descendants are from West Africa through the Atlantic slave trade, have you ever read that children's book about Black people flying?
I have not. What's it called?
I'm going to put it in the show notes. My mom used to read them all the time, and it's like this this book about Black American folk tales. And one of the largest ones in the book is about how when we die, we fly. And we're trying to fly back into the ocean to find our ancestors that were pushed over, and we meet them. And then we fly back to our motherland because even though we don't know where we are from, our souls always know how to go home. And that was a story that I listened to and read over and over again as a child. So maybe you are of the mer people, and that is beautiful.
Water is fluid and water is strong. So it really feels like an appropriate analogy.
I love this. Okay. So Brisha, the descendants of the Black mer people. Ariel's second cousin. We are talking today. I laugh because it's a very important subject and a very deep subject. And I almost fell to the floor when you presented it to me via email. And we are talking about addressing white grief within Black liberation. So let's break this down like a fraction.
Absolutely. We say it on the surface. And it might sound like a mess, but bear with me. Bear with me.
Oh, yes. And for the record, I think that even when we break it down in this conversation, honoring the fact that it is a mess is like the most foundational thing. This is messy. This is messy. So I first want to define what Black liberation is to you.
Black liberation is about Black people able to safely live into and embody the fullness of our humanity from feeling sad, feeling angry, being dark, being fat, being queer, whatever it might be, with safety and without threat to our actual being.
How does that play out in corporate spaces?
It what doesn't.
Is that true? And there you have it, folks. So why does it not? Because you know that I agree with you, but I want you to be more specific. Why does it not there?
Typically when people incorporate just in leftist spaces think about violence against African Americans, their minds go to the more explicit forms, you know, being called the N-word or police violence or something along those lines, when the violence we experience is much more pervasive and insidious. And quite frankly, it is the implicit violence and the, microaggressions that we experience every day that is significantly more damaging than our being compared to the police violence that we may or may not encounter. It is possible for a Black person to live in this country and not face police violence or not face, not be called the N-word. But it is not possible for us to extract ourselves from work environments. For us, it would be corporate. It is not possible for us to extract ourselves from the medical system, from the housing system, all of which compromise our ability to live and thrive. And in that way, those invisible forms of discrimination are much more threatening to our overall well-being.
I agree. I think it's very interesting when corporate spaces require people to answer the question, especially Black bodies, of why did you leave that company? Because I always tell people, I'm like, whenever I get that question, it's interesting to me, as if you're insinuating that I wanted to leave, that I wasn't pushed out of the company. Okay, so cool. So now that we've defined that, what is white grief?
Ooh, oh, where do we even start? All right, so typically when people talk about grief, they think about concrete loss, things that they have lost either in the present or in the past. When in reality, grief is something that we exist in all the time, and it includes fear of future loss. There is not a culture, a being, at any point in time that has not experienced fear of loss, fear of losing our lives, fear of losing our safety, fear of losing our loved ones. And when talking about white grief, I'm specifically focusing on what white people are afraid to lose from their privilege, their sense of safety, and their identity, and the actions they will take subconsciously to prevent that loss.
Which is wild, right? Because when I think about my lineage in the United States, and even broader, just in Western society and what that means, living and existing in colonialism, I think about all of the things and systems and creativity that my ancestors have made under the violence of white supremacy. And I can only imagine if that was not a shield on us or a cape on us, how much more we could do that could also benefit white people.
I mean, I don't have anything to add to that. Human beings, we are going to be who we are going to be. When I talk about systemic oppression, I aim to look at it holistically because in my opinion, if we ended white supremacy tomorrow, it would take us 2 minutes to come up with some other system of oppression, because if humans don't do nothing else, we're going to find a way to oppress another group of people.
And speak on it.
And for me, the question is, what is the root of that? What is the root of us either oppressing Black Africans or oppressing women for the past 12,000 years via patriarchy? What is the common thread that causes people to want to do this to another human being? And for me, I believe that it is the reality or our awareness that we have things to lose. And out of our desire to protect what we have to lose, we will take any and everything from someone else. So if we take slavery, for example, white people recognize that time is precious. They need resources to get food and build comfort. So what do? They go hijack other human beings, place us in these violent conditions so that we are generating income for their comfort, so that they have more time with their family in a more convenient life, because we're out here working nonstop. So, and if I would say the same about patriarchy as well, for women to have to pick up the extra emotional and physical labor so that men can move through the world more freely.
So then are we suggesting that human nature is to actively decide, I cannot exist and thrive without being on the back of someone else?
Absolutely. And until we do the intentional work of dismantling that unexplored grief, that is how it manifests. that is why it has to be very intentional for us to be aware of our relationship to grief and to even recognize fear of loss as a type of grief. And to not just look at grief as things that have already happened.
So what is the work? Let's get into the work. I think that's the most important part of this conversation. What types of work do we collectively need to do? Because I also want to be very clear, we don't have to call out Black Americans and the own people. Our relationship in oppression with queerness, even though the Black church, I think, is one of the queerest places you could ever go. And I hope all the pastors and reverends are listening from the South because they're going to be mad. But it just exudes queerness to me as a straight Black American woman. So this is everywhere. What do we need to do?
Well, going back to your comment, I'm from South Carolina and I'm also ordained. I went to divinity school. So I am a reverend in the Zen Buddhist tradition. I grew up Southern Baptist. I still consider myself culturally Baptist. I love my Baptist people, my Baptist church. I will be at revival and a cookout in a heartbeat. So
We love revival. I do.
So that's just going to be me and a part of me. But my practice in terms of coming to these realizations and really being able to look at it and healing has come from Buddhism, where we have something called the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths are entirely about suffering, the reality of suffering, the cessation of suffering, liberation from suffering. And within that, we also focus very much on impermanence or fear of loss as being a cause of suffering and clinging, having attachments to the things that we fear losing, not only causing suffering for ourselves, but for other people. And for the Fourth Noble Truth, when thinking through liberation, Buddhists prioritize meditation and mindfulness to bring awareness and to eliminate personal suffering, and then taking that awareness and applying it to the world to eliminate the suffering of other people. Does that make sense?
You know, as you say that, I think about Tina Turner.
Yes. So we're not in the same tradition. What was it? I forgot, but
y'all can Google it. But to get folks involved, you know, and Tina Turner is like the quintessential celebrity Black Buddhist, is that she was also raised Southern Baptist and was placed in a position, unfortunately, very young to be taken advantage of mentally, spiritually, physically, emotionally by her music partner turned husband. And before she transitioned, RIP to the Queen, who, yes, I cried when I found out she died, she became a Buddhist. She like started learning about Buddhism on her free time as she was in this very abusive relationship. And throughout her life, she said what got her through that relationship was Buddhism. And so I bring that back to you. Because as a person who doesn't know a lot about Buddhism, what you just said makes sense to why, in her opinion, Buddhism saved her. Because she separated the suffering of loss or the grief of future loss with herself. And I guess in many ways became peaceful and comfortable with this idea that I'm going to be okay and I'm going to thrive regardless of all this other stuff this abusive relationship gives me.
I have been practicing for 10 years and just hearing you say that really touched me. And it really touched my spirit. That is beautifully said. I don't remember her specific or her particular tradition. I know that each tradition has its own practices similar to Christianity. Not fully familiar with her chants, but I do very clearly remember those scenes. And I think for Black women in particular, having a tradition, a spirituality where we can turn to make sense of our suffering, or just like the reality of suffering, is a very beautiful thing. And see, this is where I have trouble with how mindfulness has been presented in our culture. Mindfulness has been presented as something intended to promote relaxation, right? When mindfulness comes from meditation, and meditation was literally derived from a tradition that is all about recognizing suffering. And the purpose of meditation is to be aware and to ground ourselves amidst suffering, not to check out and relax from it. Because being grounded and being relaxed are two totally different things. And if one is aware, there's no way you can relax when you're looking at what's going on. Your job is to be present and aware so that you can attend to your suffering and the suffering of other beings, whether in corporate, in your day-to-day life, what have you.
But then I would argue also that it's very hard for oppressed people, and we can insert whatever identity layer you'd like to insert of oppression, for us to acknowledge and sit in our suffering, because it's so much easier in order to survive. It is so much easier to run from it or just pretend it doesn't exist. That's survival 101.
This is something I was covering. So I teach a 6-week certificate program on healing white grief. And Our last class was on sitting amidst the unforgivable. What does it mean for us as Americans to every day, Black people, white people, to live and exist amongst each other on this land, knowing that moment from moment, we are existing amidst the unforgivable. We're existing amidst the attempted genocide of Native Americans. We are existing amidst the humanization of African-Americans. And then there are white people who are some who desire to build connections and friendships and have to have this cognitive dissonance where they cannot fully come to terms with the weight of what white supremacy has allowed them to do and the weight of that suffering on us. So to exist all the time amidst the unforgivable is impossible. like you said, we can't live.
So is this our first step for your strategy in how handling grief for Black liberation is to acknowledge and sit in it, sit in the suffering?
Yeah, but more so for white people. Which is why my focus is specifically white grief. We know we're suffering.
Oh, I do. For the record, I am suffering.
We are suffering.
I know that I'm suffering. For the record, I do not need any more suffering.
Nope.
I'm good, sis. I'm good.
You don't need any teachings about your suffering.
Nope.
You don't need to be, you are good. We are good. Mm-hmm. We have got each other. We got ourselves. White people, on the other hand, even the most well-intentioned, really need to understand what, instead of trying to ask what do we need to succeed, the question is what do they need to do to not impede? And that means that they need to attend to their grief and do their work, because it's all fine and dandy to give us ERGs to go to and to hire more quote unquote diverse employees. But if the moment we leave that ERG, we still got 39 hours of putting up with abuse, then, I mean, the math don't make sense, which means that the people who are responsible, intentionally or unintentionally, for that suffering need to figure out what they once again can do to not impede.
I would even argue this whole thing about hiring, having all these strategies for hiring Black and brown people, but not having a strategy for retention is violent. But you know, Brisha, folks don't want to hear from me, okay? Because when I say that at work, people look at me like I have three heads, okay?
God forbid you call attention to what's actually going on.
Right? Because the hiring and the recruitment of Black and brown bodies in these corporate white spaces and not having a retention plan, which one of those many layers includes what you're saying of like, white managers handle your ish, do not continually oppress this person, can bring more suffering to that person. So what is the strategy in your opinion and expertise of how white people deal with their own grief? Because I love what you said about it's not just the grief of your ancestors, it's also the grief of your future.
So a lot of my work has, of course, been grounded in education, but education isn't enough. This is fundamentally a spiritual issue. It is fundamentally a human issue. So my approach to this has very much been grounded in how do we attend to the spirit? How do we sit with awareness and all of those uncomfortable things? How do we sit with the reality of knowing that the person or the thing that we love most, we will absolutely lose them at some point in time, either while we're living or because we die? How do you sit amidst that and get real, not comfortable, but get comfortable with that discomfort and use that awareness to build a more fulfilling life for yourself, as opposed to stealing the fulfillment from other people?
I mean, yeah, my dad, who I do talk about often on this podcast because he has one-liners for days, told me at 5 years old, the only thing guaranteed in life is that you will stay Black and die. And what you choose to do in that space with those two realities is honestly your decision.
That's both hilarious and deep. Stay Black. Like, there's nothing in this world that will change the identity and implications that come with that. Yep. You are going to stay Black.
And I will die.
Yeah.
And that sounds very morbid and sad, but it's true. And I think—
because of it.
Right, right. And I think, and you know, I had the crazy militant parents who always talked to me like I was 30, even at 2. And I think that his point, when he still continues to say that, is not to be morbid, but to remind my generation, my cousins, siblings, et cetera, that you have a finite amount of time on this earth before you go to the next life. And so what do you want to do?
In Zen Buddhism, after our evening sit, after every evening sit, we say the evening gatha, which is life and death are of supreme importance. Time passes swiftly. An opportunity is lost. Let us awaken, awaken, take heed. Do not squander your life. After every night sit, as a reminder.
That's real. And correct me if I'm wrong, but many Buddhists believe in reincarnation.
Yeah. Yes. I would say it's not, at least for Zen Buddhism, it is not the central focus.
Okay.
But yes, yes, yeah. In Zen Buddhism, it's more of, there are, I believe, six hell realms, actually, than you. Anyway, actually, this is a longer conversation, or I didn't mean to, let me make this concise. So in Buddhism, in Zen Buddhism, they are more symbolic than concrete. So there is one method of reincarnation, or one realm called embodied by the hungry ghosts. And the hungry ghosts are people who are forced to live with throats that are so small that it even hurts to eat a grain of rice. And each life you live and what you've done in that life determines which realm you're going to be in. And for hungry ghosts, that can be— those people can be described as energy suckers in their previous life, where they were constantly stealing resources or whatever from other people. And now they are in a realm where they experience hunger and desolation and understand what it was like to take in their previous life.
It's very karma.
Yes.
See, I'm not a Buddhist. I also do not believe in reincarnation because I told people I'm not trying to come back here.
Look, listen, we're going to have to come back to that. We're going to have to come back to it.
I'm not trying to come back here. I tell people that I'm going to Wakanda because I'm not coming back here. Okay. My question to you, regardless of what people believe in and the next phase transition of what happens after. So what do Black people, Black folks, what do we do if we do something within this white grief? I loved how you said in the beginning how this is not on us. But is there something that we can do to propel white people or people oppressing of us to figure this out? Or do we just have to sit here and take these lashes until folks just wake up one day?
I feel like that's a trick question. It is not. I feel like anything that Black people do, as long as it doesn't come at the expense of someone else, to alleviate our suffering is fine, including completely checking out. Like, it is not incumbent upon every Black person to try to save an entire community from people who are hell-bent on not trying, right? Some of us are called to do that in different ways. Some of us are in corporate doing that work. For me personally, I do this work with the people I am choosing to teach. For me, going back to the whole you trying to peace out of here, that is tied to my vows. So in order to become lay ordained, I had to go through something called Chukai. And during that, I vowed to be what we call a bodhisattva. So instead of ever at any point in time moving on to Buddhahood, I am committing to come to staying on earth and to the and to attempt to alleviate the suffering of all beings at all costs. And that for me means being in the midst of great suffering, taking on that responsibility of trying to take care of my community by focusing on the oppressor and teaching them what they need to do. Now, I took that vow, and I'm going to keep it real. Many days I wake up and I look at the world and people, I'm just like,
nah,
I can't believe I swore to stay here with y'all. Like, I really said this. But it's
if
done.
I got a thing for, I'd be like, and covers over my head.
Oh my God.
So how do you keep doing it? For someone to make a vow like that, number one, not many people in the world make a vow like that, especially in such a sacred space. Like, it's one thing to be like, you know, I promise. It's another like New Year's Eve, but you made a vow in a divine sacred space. How does that work for you? How do you, and this is a very granola question, how do you take care of you while making that vow?
I see the practice as taking care of me. So the thing about chaplains, we go through around 4 to 5 years of training. It includes divinity school. It includes a 1-year residency where we are supervised and fully integrated on whatever team we're working on. For me, it was a hospital working 60 hours a week. Then being out in the field, going through board certification. So all of that, and a part of it is endorsement from one's spiritual tradition and frequently ordination. I want to be very clear. Chaplains who go through this training do not proselytize. There are chaplains who are out here with their church doing what they do, and then there are ones who are hired by an institution and hopefully have a little more sense. So for me, being embedded within my practice and spiritual community gives me the resources to keep going out and doing this work, and also being comfortable to say, with saying, I feel tired, I feel angry, I feel I'm going to take this break. I have these boundaries.
What about the spiritual world? I'm defining that as any kind of spiritual world. As a person who was raised in a Black Baptist church in the South, even as a child, I was very interested in learning about other religions because I think religion is very beautiful. I think spirituality is very beautiful. I also think that Southern Black Baptist religion is actually this very interesting conglomeration of Islam, Christianity, and African religious tradition, but people don't want to hear all that, but it's true. How in which we practice, how in which we preach, how in which we sing, that's not just Christianity. And for folks who've never been to a Black Baptist church or a Pentecostal church on a Sunday, I highly recommend you do just to observe, because it's not just Christianity. And I hate to get all nerdy and preachy in history, but there are many churches in the South that were built right after slavery officially on paper ended, that literally have Islam teachings, Islam messages, and Islam symbols in the pews. So that's a whole separate conversation. But what attracts you to not only be a part of spirituality in this way, but use it to guide this deeper conversation about racism and Black liberation?
I think the same thing that drew my ancestors to it. I'm from South Carolina, and there are two songs that come to mind. And the lyrics for one is, my hope was built on nothing less than Jesus's love and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus's name. On Christ, the solid rock I stand. All other ground is sinking sand. And when I think about those words, it actually comes from, I don't know, some waspy hymn. I have no idea. But when our people sing it, when I tell you that the person who sings the song and puts spirit into a song can change the entire meaning.
Oh my God, yeah.
Our ancestors had to find some place to protect and bury our humanity and our connection to God where oppressors could not touch it. And that was within the church and within our songs, right there in plain sight. And the way we chose to sing and the beats we chose and the way that we chose to express the word, all of that came from the deepest attempt to preserve our spirit and humanity while living amidst depravity. For myself, as a queer Black woman who experiences violence, various types of violence on a daily basis, I too have found comfort, not just comfort, it's deeper than comfort. I too have been able to protect my spirit, in fact, to deepen my spirituality within these traditions. And the funny thing is, people frequently ask me, you know, oh my gosh, sometimes when I go to Black churches and I give somewhat of a sermon or give a talk, I am approached by elders within the church asking, why did I leave and how could they get me back? And the fact of the matter is, I didn't leave. God is so much more vast than we comprehend, and I refuse to take my God and trap them within the box of my tradition and religion. I will say that being Southern Baptist gave me depth through my ancestors, and Buddhism gave me the strength and the shovel to keep digging further into that depth without becoming spiritually undone.
Okay, so I'm gonna have to ask you before we close. So I know that you have worked in a corporate setting. We all know that I work in a corporate setting. I definitely have a gospel playlist in the name of, it's either the try Jesus, not me mode or the F around and find out mode.
Yep.
What's on your playlist, Grisha?
Actually, try Jesus, find me. Or sorry, try Jesus, not me. A lot of the songs I listen to are from home. One is called If I Had Wings Like a Dove, and another is called Calvary. So I tend to go old school with my songs, not really the mainstream stuff. If I were to pick mainstream, I would say, no, I just don't listen to mainstream like that. You'll find me in the Carolinas.
Which is a whole separate, we should bring you back for season three. Like being a Black person in the Carolinas is a whole separate subculture of Black. We're talking about Gullah Geechee. We're talking about rice. Like it's a whole thing that people should Google. Earlier today, I was in a very hard meeting and I just started playing That's When You Bless Me. Cause I'm like, whoo, y'all about to get it.
If people want somewhat mainstream, but also very old school, Southern old school. My grandmother swears by Willie Banks and Lee Williams and the Spirituals. I mean, you know what you listen to. I was like great uncle at the cookout. So not even the uncle who's walking around with the Bluetooth and the socks and the flip flops. Like, pre that uncle. I don't know who the uncle is that gave birth to the other one, but I mean, Deacon Uncle.
Yes. With the crocodile shoes?
With them. Ooh, yes. And with them suit pants that are a little too big.
Yes. And then you know you have to have the hat that matches the crocodile shoes. And when you're a kid in these Black churches, you're like, I've never met a lavender crocodile, but his crocodile shoes are in fact lavender.
I don't know why I never paid attention to that.
Oh, see, when I went to church, I never listened to the scripture. And now I feel like a heathen. Lord bless my 10-year-old spirit. But church for me was a cultural experience. It wasn't really a spiritual experience. It was a cultural experience. And it's where I felt most connected culturally to my ancestors. So church for me was watching the fashion show known as Black fashion. And no one could tell me that a middle-aged Black woman cannot dress.
You want to move right? into that, huh? You want to talk about them church hats, huh?
The church hats, girl, right? And I remember growing up, like, that's why I enjoyed going to church. It wasn't the sermon. It was the glorification of culture. It wasn't the words in the sermon. It was how the sermon was presented. It wasn't the words in the choir. It was the fact that, oh, we just had a whole 20-minute concert.
We did.
For free.
We surely did.
And it was also just connecting with other Black children who also, whose parents align with this culture. I've never felt so connected to my ancestry until I was in a Black church, which is funny because I'm clearly aware that my ancestors, many of them pre-colonialism, were not in a Black church. But that's how I feel connected to them. It's weird.
Okay, preacher. Preacher, preach.
Even though I haven't been in a Black church in over a decade. But like, y'all don't hate me. I remember the good times. And I have my gospel playlist when I need it. So, Bridget, how can we follow you? How can we support you? What is going on? I love what you're doing, and I'm very grateful. More than love, I'm in gratitude with what you are doing.
Thank you for that. People can go to my website, BreishaWade.com. They can follow me on Instagram. The handle's pretty straightforward, Instagram.com/BreishaWade. A lot of my work involves working with executives and managers offering consulting or coaching on white grief and how attending to white grief can lead to healthier teams and support diverse employee retention. And most frequently, I get reached out to about speaking engagements as well as workshops. So that is what I do. That is what I will continue doing, as well as offering my certificate programs to professionals who are interested in understanding white grief on an individual level as an individual contributor so that they can help shift their team's culture.
Please let me know how I can continue to support you, because this is very hard work. I say this often, but I think that, well, I won't speak for the whole Black community because I can't, because Black is not a monolith. Regardless of what people think, I prioritize my life in a very strategic way where I say God, my family, and community. And I think that freedom fighting looks different. Just how we twerk different.
I mean, freedom fighting,
right? Twerking is also not a monolith, fam. We are allowed to freedom fight differently. And so even though your freedom fight may look a little different, it is still very much a militant freedom fight that we need. So I hope that you continue your freedom fight because it is needed and it is wanted because we aren't liberated yet. So we need to keep it moving.
I appreciate that, Lexi. Thank you.
Have a good one.
You can listen to You Can Sit With Us episodes on Spotify. For more information, visit our website, lexib.com, and our LinkedIn account at LexiB. And make sure to follow our podcasts on Instagram @SitWithLexiB. And don't forget to subscribe to our Spotify channel.